This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jeronimo Cortina, political scientist and associate director at the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Houston.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, political science professor here at the University of Houston. Thank you for joining us and talking politics. Again, it's a massive week. I, though, Jeronimo, this week feel like that skyscraper-sized cargo ship that's wedged in the Suez Canal right now and literally nothing else could get by. I feel like that. So we need to unblock this and like talk politics because there's so much going on that's right behind it, right?
I don't know how the ship got stuck.
You have to make like a 3,000-point turn to get from one side to the other. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it's all going to work out just like in American politics.
Right.
We've got a really lengthy list of things happening, and you know, only a handful of them are actually like legislative stuff that's going on right now in Austin. But we're going to get to all of it here for you all, our faithful viewers and listeners. Thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Viewers.
And talking politics. Yeah, people like to watch us because how good we are. It's like we are so resonant. Like,
I feel you. All right.
Don't judge how people watch/listen to our podcast. Right. Speaking of judging, let's talk about what's happening in Iowa, but also by way of the U.S. House of Representatives.
So basically, in the outcome of the November election in a southeastern Iowa district, where the GOP candidate, now Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, won one of the closest races in American political history with only six votes out of 400,000.
Don't say your vote doesn't matter. Six votes, right?
Yep,
that is
six
crazy.
Votes. So then the Democrat opponent, Rita Hart, she refuses to concede because in theory, there's 22 discarded ballots that if they're discarded, she would have made the winner of the election.
22 ballots at question. Yeah, but again, like amazing, right?
Okay, so that's the numbers, the legally stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But now let me ask you, Brandon. We have, in January 6th, some members of Congress, right, from the Republican Party, saying that Congress has the constitutional
responsibility
to get rid of an election, et cetera, et cetera. The Democrats were in flames, saying like, oh my God, you're insane. And now Democrats seem to be under the same path. What's going on?
Right. Now Democrats are saying, let's let the House decide instead of the courts or local election officials. And Republicans are saying, why are you doing that? We should let local officials, you know, be in charge of that instead of the House. It's a bizarre kind of flipped of the script, right? And obviously has implications for the future, because if this is the kind of thing that's going to happen regularly, then it's going to be, jamming up the whole political works, as well as, I think, creating a lot of bad will among local election officials. So that's, I think, a precedent that doesn't want to be set. And frankly, it hasn't really been set, right? There have only been 110 times in history where there's been contested election cases that have gone to the House of Representatives. Only three of them have resulted in the winner being ousted and replaced. So it's a really rare thing, and I think a bad precedent and an unusual set of hypocritical changes from both parties, right?
Right.
So that's why I like to highlight it, because it shows that no one is immune from these kinds of political changes. But again, I feel like trusting local election officials is the way to go. So that's probably the line that we should take, but that's not exactly what's happening. So we'll see how that plays out. Another interesting scenario happening in a state that's very close to Iowa in Missouri is that you've got Eric.
Wait. Missouri?
You can,
because it has an I at the end.
I always say Missouri just to say, like, you should stay in Missouri. Sorry to people from Missouri, but that's what I always say.
I think it's Missouri.
You can say anyway. Missouri too. I think it's all valid. If people have questions, they can let us know how precisely to pronounce it, right?
Okay, gotcha.
You can't say Arkansas, but, you know.
It is Arkansas. We had that discussion before. When going there is an S at the end of the name of the state.
It's a hot button thing for us. Our friendship is bigger than the state pronunciation. We're going to move on, right? We're going to move past it.
Perfect. So what happened? What's going on in Missouri?
What's harder to move past, though, are former charges, scandalous charges against the Republican governor who resigned, Eric Greitens. He is now back on the stage because he is trying to replace retiring Senator Roy Blunt. He, as I said, resigned from office following allegations that he had photographed a woman nude without her consent in an effort to blackmail her into keeping quiet about an extramarital affair. He also was fined almost $200,000 by the Missouri Ethics Commission for campaign finance violations. So he's not a great candidate. And the Republicans are worried, right? I mean, they're worried that because they are defending 20 seats, that they're going to be stretched thin. They're also worried that this is an easy win for them, probably. This is a red state. They should be able to win this no problem. But if they've got a flawed nominee, all of a sudden it looks like, you know, they're like a Roy Moore from Alabama, right, who went down in flames and took the party to some degree down with him. So what do you make of this? Is this going to be a real problem for the Republicans in the next cycle?
I think so. I mean, and even Senator Josh Hawley, that at the time that Greitens was governor, he was the attorney general, right? He called on Greitens and said, you need to resign immediately, when he resigned and was asked again, according to some media reports. Josh Hawley said that he still stands by that statement. He said that he should have resigned immediately. So I think that there's going to be division. One of the most darlings of Trump political allies, Senator Hawley, is opposing already that Eric Greitens is going to be running for, you know, potential candidate.
Yeah. And the current attorney general in Missouri there, Eric Schmidt, is running and is clearly going to make an issue of this. Political comebacks after scandal are rare. It does happen, right? I mean, remember Mark Sanford ran again after resigning the governorship after affairs became public. He lost his seat in 2018, but he held his old congressional seat for a couple of years. So it does happen, but it's really rare. And the Republicans are pretty worried. But hey, speaking of scandal, let's go directly to the White House, where there's been some controversy this week. Several White House staffers have been asked to resign, were suspended, or some other kind of administrative leave after it is revealed that several of them had used marijuana in their past life. Past life in a
past life as sense, before
they went to the White House.
The White House. Yeah.
Sorry, it's too early still. But so this feels a little hypocritical to me. I mean, for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is a situation where many states, including the two countries that border the U.S., have legalized marijuana, and the regulations are pretty murky, so that some of the administration officials have been asked to sign a pledge to not use marijuana after they've said that they have used it, and some have been sort of just dismissed, so it's unevenly applied. It's unusual. I mean, Biden's an old school kind of Democrat. I think he's not necessarily progressive on the issue, but Kamala Harris is, and so there's a bit of a White House divide there. So I wonder how that's going to kind of play out in the future, where this is a White House that needs to be able to work with the progressives to be able to make things happen.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it points out this tension between states and states' laws and federal law. And it needs to be modernized and it needs to be everything. I mean, it's like if you were in the 1920s, right? And you had a drink and work in the White House, and well, you can't because there's probation, right? And, you know,
you're going to get a stern wag of the finger from, you know, Calvin Coolidge. Like,
exactly. So eventually it has to be modernized. I mean, if you're smoking pot at the White House.
Yeah. Briefing room, like, we should ask you to, you know, step outside
25 feet away from the door.
You can't have that
like
on
that.
Federal property. Yeah,
exactly. So, but, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing. I don't think that, you know, Biden per se is going to fight it. I mean, it's one of these things that is going to pass. He's going to move forward and people don't really pay much attention anymore.
Yeah. Well, speaking of not paying much attention, you know, former presidents don't always get a lot of press, although Barack Obama has a new podcast with Bruce Springsteen. So, you know, plug for that.
Scratch that, because they're not going to plug ours.
Cut that. Yeah. So. Maybe they will, though, if we're nice to them.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Well, as I said, former presidents don't always get a lot of attention, but one former president, at least the wax statue of, is getting some attention. In a wax museum in downtown San Antonio, many of you have probably been there across from the Alamo, had to remove a wax statue of Donald Trump after it was repeatedly vandalized. People apparently were trying to punch it in the face. To me, it seems that the hitting of the face is probably the best scenario here. Like, it could be a lot worse.
Right.
So this is...
They also said, the museum administrators, that this is normal, that happens many times with celebrities and former presidents and stuff. But still...
You just take your aggressions out on this.
Exactly. So they, but they decided that, you know, the scratches in the face and everything had were too much, and they needed to protect the integrity of the wax statue. So
there you go. Seems fair to me, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're all about protecting things, and it's a challenge, obviously, sometimes to do so. And there's been debate in Texas, especially, switching to talking about the Lone Star State, about how to protect consumers from being overcharged or from the kind of rampant increases in energy prices that happened during Snowmageddon. This week, the lieutenant governor, who has battled on this issue, went to Governor Abbott, basically pleading with him to take executive action to reverse the billions of dollars in charges that were leveled against many people during that Snowmageddon. It's interesting to me, not just because it's an important issue about how to deal with this pricing issue, but also because you've got the lieutenant governor and the governor butting heads. That doesn't happen very much. It does happen on occasion. And the kind of equilibrium unbalancing is complicated for a session which is really heating up right now. So I think that Patrick genuinely dislikes government. And I think that he wants to see the maladministration changed and reformed. And so he's really, as he says, taken this on his back. But to me, it also says something more about the role that the lieutenant governor plays. So it's about the battle lines between him and the governor, but it's also between the lieutenant governor in the Senate and what's happening in the House, because Dade Phelan, the Speaker of the House, said he wouldn't necessarily move to change this repricing issue. He was going to side with Governor Abbott, saying there's not much we can do about it. So to me, there's a kind of clear alliance forming there. The other is that you see the House willing to stand up to Patrick and say, we're not going to do this, even though you've passed legislation and are kind of, you know, really bullhorning this. So I'm interested to see kind of what you think about what this all means to Texas government, but also to like the consumers who are kind of, you know, on the hook for some of this money.
It's not only that, right? I mean, you see Lieutenant Governor Patrick like siding on the side of consumers
right.
and defending them, right? That's another take that you can take. Mm-hmm. Like, this is wrong. They overcharged, or they kept it for 36 hours or 32 hours more than that what they were supposed mm-hmm. to be charging. So you have $4 billion or something like that that consumers were charged extra on the one hand, right? And then you have also Lieutenant Governor Patrick butting heads with the Agricultural Commissioner Miller and then Dr. Holtze that sued Patrick for requiring COVID tests.
Yeah.
And then Patrick comes back and said, well, if we want to keep the thing running, right, the most sensible thing is to test people so no one gets infected and we don't have to shut down the business of the people.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, right? Now I'm thinking.
I like it.
That maybe Dan Patrick is going to change parties and he's going to become a liberal.
Wow. What is that? What is in that cup you're drinking? speaking of weed in the White House, I mean, I'm fascinated by this dynamic because you're exactly right. So Ag Commissioner Miller and Dr. Steve Hotze, both very conservative, joined with Gerald Whitfield, who's a former GOP chair in Harris County, to sue the lieutenant governor, saying that the medical procedures required to enter the Senate are effectively restricting free speech, which is sort of access to government, which is sort of a cornerstone of the constitutional governance in Texas and in the country. It's unusual because, yeah, you normally don't see Dan Patrick get somebody to the right of him, right? That is a rare thing.
Right.
And so that's unusual. I mean, look, Dr. Hotze and Jared Woodfill have been pushing to the right on all kinds of issues for a long time. So this is not like out of step with them. What's interesting to me is Miller joining them. So to me, maybe it's the case that Sid Miller on your kind of electoral timeline there is sniffing out a run, looking to see if he's got enough backing on this to move to the right of Dan Patrick, if not to challenge Patrick to maybe replace Patrick once Patrick's gone. So that could be something. But on the general kind of issue, I guess the question is whether or not the courts would agree that this is a reasonable restriction on free speech or access to government. I think that they probably would, given the circumstances. It's made a little more challenging because the House didn't do the same, right? They don't require the same COVID test for entry. But all of the members of the Senate agreed. All of the Republicans agreed in the Senate too. So obviously there's enough support to make this happen to back Patrick that I'm not sure it's going to go anywhere. But it is curious to see the politics of this play out.
Right. But once again, this underlines the important issue of our times, and is that everything, every single thing becomes a political and ideological issue.
Yeah.
Test for COVID.
Yeah.
Period. I mean, like, it's very simple.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the argument that Patrick is making,
right?
Yeah.
It's common sense, right? And if you go back to pre-partisan polarization, right? Texas politics used to be, if ain't broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah.
Very down-to-earth, very practical. Let's focus on the things and not the political issues. So anyways. So
well, I think now it's, you know, even if it's broke, let's consider fixing it.
Exactly.
Maybe, right? That's kind of the ethos now.
I mean, just ERCOT and the POC.
Yeah.
When you read these bills are not actually fixing the thing. Right. They're not fixing anything. It's like, well, now we're going to have, instead of three, we're going to have five commissioners or potential commissioners. Two are going to be someone that knows how to jump the rope stationary, the other one that can stand up their head. I mean, but
then they can have three people jumping and two people doing the rope, right? Is that
exactly
what you're saying? Like, it is like the ever given stuck in the Suez Canal, right? It doesn't matter how much you rearrange the deck chairs on it, it's still stuck no matter what. But on that point, though, I mean, as you said, this is a legal question as well as a political question. And we've got an interaction between both of those things this weekend because the Texas Supreme Court, in a very closely divided decision, ruled that ERCOT has legal immunity that will shield it from billions of dollars in blackout-related claims. This is actually a case that predates Snowmageddon, so it's working its way through the courts. But basically, the question was whether or not ERCOT can be held accountable for things like poorly conceived power supply forecasts or pricing errors, things like that. So the court split 5-4, the majority deciding that a legal technicality jurisdiction issue prevented it from weighing in on ERCOT's immunity. So effectively, the lower court decision stands, which means ERCOT is immune from these kinds of things. This is not great politics. It's a split decision. So you've got effectively one issue there for many of them who have to run for office. So you've got a 5-4 split. Of the five people in the majority who punted on this issue, four of them have been appointed and are going to have to run for re-election. So that could be a political liability for them on a big issue that normally people wouldn't be that attentive to in the courts, but this is a sizable political issue. So I suspect you're going to see this on several ads when Democrats come to hunt for these Republicans.
Well, absolutely.
Statewide.
I mean, and Chief Justice Nathan Hedge, he said that, you know, and
in
I
dissent,
quote,
right?
Exactly, in the dissent. So that's also very telling, right? Mm-hmm. A judge that is a conservative, he said, the parties want to know, the public wants to know, the court refuses to answer. So those are very powerful words and only highlight that. To me, even on one side of the political spectrum, people want answers, right? And people want the government and the courts to do their job. It's not about a technicality. It's for the love of God. I mean, it's a technicality, but we need those answers, right? Yeah. We need those answers. We need the legal certainty and a position that the Texas Supreme Court needs to take.
Yeah. And well, you know, speaking of the kind of political issues, we've got a pretty big announcement this week, actually. Democratic Representative Filemon Vela has announced that he will not seek re-election. He was in a pretty tough district, a changing district. This is a district which essentially spans most of the eastern Rio Grande Valley and up kind of north towards San Antonio. it's a district that he has progressively kind of lost more ground to. There's been a surge in support among Latinos for Trump, although we will obviously talk about what that means and if that's really true. But the district has shifted more than 10 points towards Republicans, going from about 19% bluer than the state to about 8 to 9% bluer than the state in 2020. He has faced the same opponent in the last three cycles, and he has outraised him like 10 to 1 and has still lost vote share. So there are some changes here. And here's what, let me just give you one to grow on. Republicans are all over the Valley. They're all over South Texas. You have Greg Abbott there for a Save Our Seniors press event in McAllen. You have Justice Guzman and George P. Bush in the Hidalgo County Republican Party dinner. You have Cruz and Cornyn in GOP delegation to the border. So the Republicans see potential. And Filemon here, Vela, believes that this is going to be a problem for him in the future. Do you think that's true? Is he jumping the gun?
I mean, I don't know if he's jumping the gun. I think he's perhaps not the right candidate, because on the one hand, yes, there has been some Latinos that have been supporting or supported Trump, right? Because we have one data point.
Yeah.
One single data point.
1 year.
1 year, right? We don't know what's going to happen eventually. Trump is out of the picture. The other Republicans don't have that charisma, don't have the appeal that President Trump had, particularly with Latinos in the RGB region. Mm-hmm. But also importantly, the Republican Party did not spend a lot of money organizing. So it was a kind of a grassroots movement of Latinos supporting President Trump. So I don't think that Filemon Vela was the right candidate, right? Yeah. On the other hand, you also have Latinos and Latinas are becoming more and more progressive.
Yeah.
So
younger
yes. Latinos mm-hmm. that are extremely more progressive than what is Representative Vela. So I think that the change will allow for this younger generation of Latinos to rise up and give a very important fight, which will also resonate among the Latinos that are looking for the same thing.
Interesting.
And that's healthcare, education, allowing them to work, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera,
et cetera. Yeah, so like I think progressive immigration change.
Right. I'm not sure that he's jumping the gun. I'm sure that he could not win. Maybe he would won re-election, but very, very, very hard. And opening the doors, you know, it's better to run than lose an election, right?
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people make that calculation. But on that very point, I mean, there are a couple of big changes, I think, that are worth noting this week. And there's sort of talk about how the parties are changing. So this week, Lee Merritt, who's a civil rights attorney in North Texas, who's represented families of several Black individuals who've been killed by police officers, says he's running for attorney general. He has represented the families of Atiana Jefferson, of Darius Tarver, also of Bonham Jean, who was killed in his apartment by an off-duty Dallas police officer. So obviously Paxton, as we've said before, is the most endangered public official statewide. And I think that this sharpens the debate about racial justice. That's something that motivates Black Democrats who felt like they've been left out of this process, especially out of the Democratic Party kind of rebuilding in Texas, right? Remember in 2020, there was all kinds of concern from Royce West and sort of people who were supporting him that they weren't being heard in the debate and or in the kind of process of choosing the nominee for the Democrats for U.S. Senate. So this is a moment potentially to crystallize that debate and really kind of focus through on that issue. The other is that you had this week a video uploaded, according to KSAT in San Antonio, that said that Kyle Biederman, representative from that area, was on the steps of the U.S. Capitol or near the steps of the U.S. Capitol as the mob clashed with Capitol police officers. I mean, Biederman obviously is to the right of his party and basically everybody. He effectively carved out that territory for himself, even introducing legislation to help Texas secede from the union. But it suggests to me that there's a real backlash to this. So this week, Joe Strauss in a podcast with Evan Smith said that he voted for Joe Biden and that he said the far right is basically a GOP cult. He also alludes to the fact that there needs to be some change. And this week, that change came. The Texas Republican Initiative was introduced this week. Basically, a group of people, including Carlos Carrasco, who was thinking about running against a Representative Vela, is establishing what they call a Texas Republican Initiative to basically be a shadow organization to the Texas GOP, which they think has gone too far to the right. So there's a lot of things happening here where the parties are kind of diverging and they're also moving more to like their kind of extreme. So do you feel like this is a problem for Texas politics? And is there a resolution to this that's going to let people meet in the middle?
Oh, God, that's a very interesting question. But I think that now those that do not think that the Republican Party, especially here in Texas, is heading to the right, in the right direction, right, are rebelling against it and going back to the center. So the real question is how the Republican Party can reset and recenter, right, and go back to those President Bush years of let's try to be civil in the discourse, et cetera, et cetera. And it was these compassionate conservatives, right? And I think that now that has been lost, and this type of Republican, like Joe Strauss, et cetera, saying like, hey, remember when we were liked? Remember when we were doing actually good things?
And remember when we dominated, right?
Right.
Like, is there a correlation between those things? Probably to some degree, right? There's a need for compassion, and no greater week than this week where the nation once again faced two mass shootings, one in Denver and one in Atlanta, and the latter of which included 8 people being killed, 6 of them Asian women, in a series of horrible incidents that obviously are related to gun violence, but also to racism against Asian Americans. Joe Biden, the president, has called for the Senate to act immediately on 2 bills that the House has passed on gun reform, including an assault weapons ban and a high capacity magazine ban, as well as closing some loopholes, despite the fact that this is the first session since the mass shootings in El Paso and in Midland, Odessa. You have both the Texas GOP leaders, Dan Patrick and Greg Abbott, saying that this is not the time to be able to make gun reform. So is anything going to happen on this? Is this just going to be a kind of more of the same? Or are we going to see some real change after these events that have really shocked the nation once again?
I mean, it's such a pity, man. I mean, the loss of human life just because a crazy person gets a gun and goes on a rampage is just unacceptable, period. So you have to separate the issue, right? Mm-hmm. You have Second Amendment issues, right? That's one stuff. And, you know, that's what it is. And it's not going to get re-amended, the Second Amendment. That's not going to happen, right? Period. However, you need to have common sense legislation. I mean, remember when we had the tragedy in Walmart in El Paso? Mm-hmm. What happened when we did our survey? Remember, we had data that highlights that people are for red flag laws on the one hand, and also for sensible regulation and sensible background checks, period.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that.
And some Republicans are willing to do that. Like John Cornyn has said that he'll back the closing of some loopholes. That's probably likely to pass. That there's a sort of different version of that bill that's working its way through. But something like an assault weapons ban is a complete non-starter, right? That's not going to pass. The background checks themselves are probably a long shot too, but you know, you've definitely got enough pressure on certain Republicans to move that needle that perhaps it could happen. But is executive orders enough? Like, Joe Biden is going to get a lot of pressure to, number one, move on this issue because this is going to be a massive gravitational shift in the politics of the day. But also, you've got progressives who are saying, you need to kill the filibuster because if you don't kill the filibuster, we'll get nothing done, including sensible, as you say, kind of gun control legislation in their opinion. So, you know, then members like, you know, Ted Cruz are saying things in hearings like, you know, this is all theater and, you know, this is just kind of Democrats playing to the cameras, and maybe it is to some degree, but it's still an issue. Like, it's a major issue. And the question is, can this work? And people have said that this kind of cooling off period might have helped the situation where you had the shooter in Denver had bought a gun 6 days before the incident took place. So a kind of longer cooling off period would be sensible in that way, which I think makes sense. And some Republicans have hinted that that would be passable.
Yeah,
but
and then
can you get 60 votes for that? I don't know.
And that and using or committing these crimes and murders against or racially motivated.
Yes, yes.
And that hatred, that racially biased hate, and we have seen it in Walmart in El Paso, no? And now in Atlanta with Asian Americans, is a completely no. I mean, period. Yeah. You cannot understand how these individuals had access to these weapons.
Yeah. And there have been sharp reviews against some members on the issue about being racially discriminatory towards Asian Americans, right? Using certain language about the coronavirus. Chip Roy was called out by Representative Grace Meng saying, you know, you can talk about what you want, but, you know, you're basically putting a bullseye on the back of every Asian American across the country. So there's been pushback on that. But again, it's troublesome because it's not clear that even these events, which are clearly shocking the nation, are going to do anything. So that's really the kind of ongoing question that I think that the nation faces, but also the state faces, because this is, again, a session where we're right before an election, and the likelihood of there being any kind of significant gun changes in terms of reforming things and limiting things is going to be pretty low.
Yeah, we'll certainly monitor what's going on in the next couple of weeks and see if there's any traction. But for this week, that's it. Potted Politics is recording the George P. Geer Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Special thanks to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. Big thanks to our producer, Troy Schultz. And special thanks, as always, to our audio engineer, Todd Big Audio Holslander.
I'm Jeronimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.